as you're all aware, I'm in many ways a fraud. I have never served. I have never been to Natal. I've never been to Zululand. And I have never given a talk, other than recently, about any element of the Zulu Wars. So the fact that Ian Knight is at the back, and I asked him to be there, is a little bit like having your driving examiner watching you practice. Apart from that, it's great. But the reason I want to give this talk today is because of the building that you're in. Today, the RLC is the really large corps, or sometimes the recruit's last chance. Following a gay wedding, it's also now known as the Real Lesbian Corps. The critical thing was that the Army Service Corps was, of course, always sleeps comfortably. When the Royal was added in December 1918, it became runaway, someone's coming. And of quite clearly, the commissariat service of the period that we're talking about, people had names for those transport and supply specialists that were not desperately nice. So I can imagine the situation where, when we're looking at the events of Rorke's Drift, if we watch most of what we regard as being popular films, Dalton, James Langley Dalton, hardly exists at all. But I'm now going to try and put things right. I'm going to put James Langley Dalton back where he should be. And I would warn you, I've normally given this talk for officers of the really large corps that occasionally feel they need a pat on the back, not least being he's one of only five VCs that the RLC have a claim to. So two of them, by the way, being for the Indian Mutiny, where the transport specialist in question served as light cavalry. This is a real VC to a supply specialist doing the real job. Now, the critical thing is that there is one set of English language you should know, and that is the words, "Now we must make a defence." Those words came from one of the defenders at Rorke's Drift. Was it Mr. Bromhead? No. Was it Mr. Chard? No. Was it a member of the 24th Foot? No. It was James Langley Dalton, who is recorded as having said those words. What are the circumstances in which, basically, a bloke who normally stacked blankets suddenly comes up with this idea? Well, let's explain a couple of things about James Langley Dalton. We've been through a very, very good account of the day leading up to the defence at Rorke's Drift. And we've now got a situation where, in the aftermath of the battle, there will be 11 VCs awarded. One of them is for James Langley Dalton, the blanket stacker. I wonder how he got that particular piece of jewellery. Well, the answer is quite simply, if we think about what we've got with Rorke's Drift, it is a forward operating base. It's a FOB, but it's not defended, which is a genius idea, whatever we think about it, and that was touched on earlier on. We've actually got a situation where there is absolutely impossible that the enemy will come across the river and attack where we're storing everything we need for the column and the hospital, which is exactly what they do, because frankly, no plan in history ever survives contact with the enemy. And as we know, when Professor Gary Sheffield described the BEF's learning curve, he was pilloried. What he now says is there is no learning curve. It's a learning Loch Ness monster. Because as we learn, the enemy respond. And in the case of the Zulus, they're not what you'd call passive. They're really quite aggressive. So they make the decision to attack. Now let's think about the situation at the moment they appear and the decision is taken to do something. Who is actually present at Rorke's Drift? Well, Acting Commissary Dalton and some store men are there. The men of the 24th Foot are there and their commanding officer. Now, their commanding officer is slightly deaf, if not profoundly deaf, depending on which account you actually take. And he's been left behind because he can be trusted to do the job, which is defending the sores, the hospital, the wounded, which they will need for the furtherance of the campaign. Elsewhere is Lieutenant Chard, who is working on the crossing of the river. So he's not actually present. The Zulus appear. There is a meeting, a discussion. There is no question that James Langley Dalton is present. And the decision is taken by Mr. Bromhead, who's the only officer there, that they will leave. The idea is they'll put the sick and the wounded onto the wagons and they will leave. Now, if you're a storekeeper, let's face it, stores are called stores because they're for storing. If they were meant to be given away, they'd be called issues, wouldn't they? Therefore, you don't want to lose them under any circumstances. Whether somebody comes with a chitter paper or it's a bloody Zulu, they're not going to have them. And what he says is to Mr. Bromhead, and I can't tell you exactly what words he uses, if we do that, they will catch us in the open and we will die. Well, probably he didn't say it that way. He probably said, remembering that Mr. Bromhead's quite deaf, is, Mr. Bromhead, if we do that, we're going to die. You know, you get the idea. And then he says, well, what should we do? Now we should make a defence. Now, what's he basing that on? Because he's a bloody blanket stack. He's a storekeeper. Well, Acting Commissary Dalton is quite an unusual character. He's been in the army for 22 years. He has actually already received his pension, having done 21 years with the 85th Regiment of Foot. He's actually finished as a colour sergeant, and he's seen active service, wait for it, in Canada, which is more like outside than it is, I must admit, Zululand. But he's also served in the Kaffir Wars, and he's used to fighting against Africans, and he's very familiar with the fighting techniques of the African. Therefore, he knows what he's talking about. And between them, they come up with the idea of building the defences, which you're aware of. At that point, Mr. Chard appears. And there is a conversation about seniority. In the film, the seniority is a matter of months. In reality, it's a matter of years, because neither of them were high flyers. Okay? Bromhead and Chard were not desperately good at what they were doing. But it was discovered that Mr. Chard is senior to Mr. Bromhead. Therefore, and this is where things could have gone horribly wrong, for the first time in his career, Mr. Chard has a command. What does he do? Well, he could have gone, you, Acting Commissary Dalton, storeman, I'm in charge, we're doing it my way. He doesn't. All he says is they need an internal wall in case the enemy break through. In fact, what happens is that when the Natal native contingent go, it allows them to shorten their defences. And I have to say, in terms of leadership, that is a very bold thing to do. To have somebody from another corps, in this case a non-bayonet strength corps, tell you basically what you should be doing, to agree with them and to make minor changes, I think shows great leadership capacity rather than being something that might be passive. In the fighting that follows, principle amongst the defenders, and we shouldn't really be surprised at this, is Mr. Dalton. Why? Because he was previously armed with rifle and bayonet. He's a good shot. At one point in the fighting, he is severely wounded, and he's a very, very good shot in the fighting. So what then happens at the end of the day? Well, you know that we win and the enemy are driven off and all of that. But then what happens is very interesting, because of course a series of VCs are awarded in May of 1879. Does Mr. Dalton get one? No. Does Schlees get one? No. Does Sergeant Reynolds get one? No, they don't. The whole of them are completely ignored. The others go to Mr. Chard and members of the 24th Foot. Basically, corps troops don't get VCs. But then there's a very interesting anonymous letter written to Punch magazine, which is published on the 28th of March 1879. In your cartoon of March 22nd, you had as a worthy head of the army thank Lieutenant Chard and Bromhead for their heroic defence of Rorke's Drift. In the background are seen men of the 24th Foot, and scattered around are quantities of commissariat supplies. Cannot you find some corner of a memorial to the only officer who was killed that night while gallantly doing his duty, acting Commissary Byrne? Should you ignore the only officer severely wounded to whom all are indebted for his advice and skill in turning his supplies of flour and biscuit into parapets? Assistant Commissary Dalton, a young officer who gained the admiration of all by erecting the last defence under heavy fire, also Acting Commissary Dunn. So somebody either has got a message or has got back and is describing by March that this situation is rather unfair. Then we get the return in July of 1879 of Sir Garnet Wolseley, because he was sent to South Africa to replace Lord Chelmsford, hardly surprising. And he sums up the feelings of the current by July about what had happened. And he said, "I presented Major Chard with his Victoria Cross." There we are. "I presented Major Chard with his Victoria Cross. A more uninteresting or more stupid fellow I never saw." I'm not saying this, okay? He said it, yeah? "Wood tells me he's the most useless officer, fit for nothing. I hear in the camp also that the man who worked hardest at Rorke's Drift was commissary officer who has not been rewarded at all." So we're getting already messages in Punch saying this isn't fair, and the guy in charge on the ground saying, hang on, whatever's gone on, it really isn't fair. Now I have to say that Chard's report that comes back is not unfair about the position of everybody who was there. He does not actually disfavour these people. However, what it then says, this. And then what we get is a letter, actually, from Chard. And it says, "It was a great degree owing to the exertions of Mr. Dalton that we were enabled to put in place, in such short a time, a state of defence which, imperfect as it was undoubtedly the means of our repulsing the Zulu attack." This is the 20th of August, 1879. "When the fugitive from his Eldwana passed by with their terrible news and expressions of the madness and attempt of defence, Mr. Dalton's calm treatments of their remarks and his example of cool determination were the greatest service in inspiring our little garrison with confidence." So this is starting to gather pace now. "He was amongst the foremost to receive the first attack on the corner of the hospital, where the deadliness of his fire did great service, and when the mad rush of the Zulus first met its check, and where by his cool courage he saved the life of a man at the Army Hospital Corps, shooting the Zulu who had seized the muzzle of the man's rifle and was in the act of assegaying them. Throughout the attack he was ever present, using his rifle with deadly effect, making sure of each man and picking off those who are annoying us with their fire or coming on to attack us with the point of their spears. At one point, after shooting one of these with his rifle, he was seriously wounded with a shot through the body. He handed me his rifle and spoke so calmly that I had no thought that he was disabled. I had no idea until afterwards the severity of his wound. For all through the night, he must have been suffering intense pain, but he continued to give the same example of cool courage." That's Mr. Chard. So I'm not trying to pretend that Chard in some ways undermines his efforts. Then we get this, and this is a situation which is very, very interesting. And this is Queen Victoria's private secretary, and it's Chard's visit to her. It's worth saying, by the way, that Bromhead was invited, but didn't go because he'd gone fishing in Ireland. That was the end of his career. He said, they spoke to me about Rorke's Drift. They could not conceive why Chelmsford did not fortify it. The defence was brilliant and stubborn, but the puzzle to them was who the man was who organised it, for it showed genius and quickness, neither of which were apparent qualifications of Chard. I didn't write this either. A dull, heavy man, scarcely able to do regular work. One day, Wood sent him to clear some ground, and when they arrived later, found him not done nothing, and he was asleep. Another day, he was sent to find a ford and make it passable. Fearing his man might cause problem, Wood rode forward, found Chard quite helpless. He didn't seem to make it clear what a ford was, and had done nothing. Yet Chard's dispatch was a good one. They hoped his portrait would not appear in Mrs. Butler's picture. He was so ugly it would spoil the work of art. Bromhead was fearless but hopelessly stupid. They could not understand. They could understand Chard and Bromhead bravely resisting to death, but they could not actively believe that they ordered the defence themselves. They both believed this defence was done by a commissary named Dalton. So we're getting on. And what we then get is this, and this is from Balmoral, from the Queen's private secretary. Chard had been here and left this morning. He explained the defence of Rorke's Drift to the Queen, Prince Leopold and the Grand Duke of Hesse, and Princess Beatrice in the Queen's private room, and did it all very clearly and modestly. After dinner, he did ditto in the billiard room on the table, where store and hospital bags were books and tables, and mealy bags were biscuit tins and billiard balls. The Queen liked his quiet, unassuming manner and the modest way in which he told the story. I gather from all that here that Dalton was quite as much, if not more, of the presiding genius than himself. What we then get is this. Message of October the 18th, 1879, from the Duke of Cambridge, Commander-in-Chief of the British Army. We are giving the VC freely, I think, but probably Mr. Dalton has as good a claim as the others for the cross for the Rorke's Drift defence. I don't think there was a case for Mr. Dunn. And then we get this. It is most humbly submitted for your Majesty's approval that the decoration of the Victoria Cross be conferred upon Acting Assistant, now Sub-Assistant Commissary James Langley Dalton of the Commissariat and Transport Departments, who has been recommended for the same by His Highness the Field Marshal Commander-in-Chief, in recognition of his conspicuous gallantry during the attack on Rorke's Drift Post by the Zulus on the night of 22nd of January 1879, as set forth in the accompanying documents. By your Majesty's the most humble servants, etc. And he gets his VC in November 1879. By the way, Schlies was also mentioned, gets his VC after Dalton. It's a long process, isn't it? To go from January to November before the last of the VCs are awarded. And the last VC awarded is awarded to a man who, at least at the beginning, got nothing. And one of the really odd things about the film Zulu, that it's done so much to inspire everybody here, including me, is that Dalton appears in the film, but only at the very end to have any place of note, as he's mentioned as being awarded the Victoria Cross. Quite why he gets it isn't made clear at all, only that he gets it. Today, when we think about the work of the RLC, when we think about what they do, it in many ways is very similar to the work that was done in the Zulu War. The technology is different, but the job is the same. Soldiers might need bullets if they fight battles, but they need water, food, fuel to be able to do their job. And interestingly enough, by the end of the battle of Rorke's Drift, the defenders are down to their last boxes of ammunition. You can imagine the paperwork that would have made Mr. Dalton, who no doubt was very unimpressed about the marksmanship, because he was able to bridge both sides, the infantrymen and the stormen. the man who is able to say, now we shall make a defence, and to warn against a retreat that would have led to a massacre. Whether or not today the term is spin, whether the Rorke's Drift VCs are spin on the defeat of the same day, doesn't matter. What matters is that there was a presiding genius. And that presiding genius was a humble storeman, a blanket stacker. Thank you very much. Ian, do you know anything?
You're talking about the film and the fact that Dalton doesn't get a very big part in the film. There's a very good book on the making of the film called Zulu with Some Guts Behind It by a chap called Sheldon Hall, who's actually a lecturer in film studies at Sheffield University. And one of the things that comes out of that is he tracked down surviving people who worked on it and their estate and all the rest of it, got all the letters from the producers and whatever. And one of the things in there is that somebody writes, when they've written the script and they're ready to start shooting all the rest of it, somebody writes a letter saying, oh, Dalton got the VC. And in fact, they'd been looking at 1879 for all the records, and because they hadn't gone as far as the end, they'd missed the fact that he was the last one awarded the VC. So they actually kind of welded him into the story at the last minute, which is why he doesn't really get the prominent role that he actually deserves. Worth pointing out that they made the film, they would have been doing the research sort of 61, 62, filmed it in 63. The first major book on the Zulu War, Donald Morris's The Washing of the Spears, came out in 66, so came out afterwards. So when they were making the film, they had access to a lot less readily available information that we do. And I always think that's one reason why clearly Dalton didn't get the prominence that he should.
And it basically, it's a sin of omission. It's not in any way deliberate.
No, yeah, absolutely.
But doesn't it actually match what really happens? That everyone goes, actually we missed it, didn't we?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. No, it's quite appropriate to the reality. Yeah, definitely. Good. So.